Should we mic up so the folks can hear us?
So you can just put it on this side. Yeah, that side.
I'll make sure the mic's out.
Good idea. Can you tell us how you got to the White House?
Sure. Before I was with now President Obama, I worked for Rahm Emanuel at the DCCC as his communications director. The DCCC is the arm of the Democratic Party that basically helps elect Democrats to the House of Representatives. And in 06, we won the House back for the first time since 1994. And before that, I was working for the Kerry campaign. I started on the Gephardt campaign, though. Before that, I worked for Senator Harkin and for Bill Luther. But when I started on the Obama campaign, I was there's only four of us, me, David Plouffe, Dan Pfeiffer, and Katie Johnson, David's assistant. It was a very small operation. I set up the wireless router.
What year was it?
07. It was January of 07. Yep. I interviewed with the president, then Senator Obama. I think it was January 2nd or 3rd. And it was before it was formal that he was going to run for president. And he said he was running. And we talked. And I started about a week and a half later. And then the exploratory went. And yeah, in fact, he taped the video where he announced his exploratory campaign in my house. Because we didn't have a lot of studios and choices and things like that.
When you talked about working for him, did he discuss with you what his notion of communications was, what he wanted?
Yeah, he did. And he's reflected that ever since he's been a candidate and now in office. He wanted to have an open and honest line of communication with the media. He wanted to be in constant contact with them because he knew that, you know, we were in a changing media environment. And in order to gain the trust of and make sure that folks knew not just what he was doing but why he was doing it, he wanted to make sure that he could communicate openly and freely with the press. And I think that he's done a good job of doing that. He's already had a couple press conferences. He's had dozens of mini avails with leaders of other countries, just on his way to other events. Done a lot of interviews, and has spent a lot of time speaking with sort of your traditional Washington-based media, and also regional media, different blogs, and different outlets that haven't traditionally been done. As you know, you're the expert.
can you tell us what he talked about as media? And when you talk about the media, what do you think of?
Gosh, it's so, I don't remember exactly what he said in that conversation, but the way media has interacted with campaigns has changed even from 06 to 08, but certainly from 2004 to 2008, in the sense that the outlets that were once critically important are no longer of the utmost importance. They're just sort of one among many. For example, in 2008, probably the way you could most drive a news story is you could leak something to the New York Times, they put it on the front page, and everybody else would be forced to follow it. The network news, other newspapers, the wires. That sort of changed in the sense that in the 08 cycle, Politico and the Drudge Report got a lot of influence because a lot of the news stories were being generated as a result of what people were chattering about on cable. And so things that happened on cable during the day ended up having a huge outsized impact on what was being covered on the evening news and what other folks were going to cover in the papers for the next day. So trying to have a big impact on Politico, Drudge, Huffington Post, different websites like that made a big difference. And now that there's no real organized opposition to what it is the president's doing, just sort of sporadic complaints or opposition from McCain and some of the Republicans, they're not able to effectively use any kind of media to distract us from what we're doing. And as a result, I think that we drive a lot more than any specific media drives, if that makes sense.
But the president normally is the one that drives news. For example, a White House, one of the reasons that White Houses have started so early in the morning is to drive the day, get things done early, have senior staff meetings, you know, some administrations have them at 7:30, so that you've got everything laid out. And the press secretary talks about what kinds of things are going to be done during the day. And Congress can't get itself organized until much later in the day.
Right.
So they're always in a position of responding. So
what seems a little different, and just today, actually, I was doing some research on the first 100 days of other presidents, is that we're forced to be a lot less reactive than other administrations have had to be on different news stories. For Bill Clinton, he had the gays and the military issue. For George H.W. Bush, he had the Contras, and he had, I guess, the savings and loan crisis was dominant. Now, we have these big crises that we're taking on one by one. Well, not one by one, all at the same time. But
One by one together.
Right, one by one together. Well, luckily, we're able to sort of choose in what order we take them on as a result, as opposed to those events pushing how we take them on.
Mm-hmm. When you've talked about communications once Obama won, did you have discussions again about communications and the way in which campaign communications is different than governing? For example, Politico can drive things because what it does is it's the tip sheet for the day. Mike Allen's playbook gives you information on particular things. But the New York Times is still is crucial because it is giving you much deeper in picture mm-hmm. on particular issues. And their goal is to bring understanding, mm-hmm. not just information, but to bring understanding to particular issues and what's behind them.
Well, we're constantly reevaluating how we deal with the media, and that manifests itself in anything from who we choose to call on at a press conference to who we choose to do an interview with, to who can get access to a certain roundtable or background briefing and things like that. Because even since we started, media has changed some. You've had the advent of Twitter, which has weirdly driven a lot of news in and of itself. But you're right in that different outlets, like the New York Times, give you a different, deeper understanding. Politico helps to let folks know what's in the morning papers, what people are reading. And so I think this new media environment has elevated a bunch of folks to having their own niche of importance, and we just have a lot of different things that we need to address and take care of, because we can't ignore the New York Times because they're less important than they used to be in comparison to everybody else, because they're still, like you say, critically important, and we have to take care of and make sure the stories are fully accurate, researched, they have the right sources in them to make sure that people get a clear picture of what it is we're doing. But we also have to do some care and feeding of Politico reporters, Huffington Post reporters, radio hosts, to make sure that, you know, bad information doesn't get out there and spread virally. Uh-huh. It is interesting, though, as you turn the corner from the campaign to governing, that right at the beginning of the administration, to a certain extent, you get some room to run. You get a little bit of room to do what you set out to do on the campaign trail without an opposition coming after you every day, using whatever form of media they might use. All you're up against are, you know, the massive challenges in the government that we're taking on, in the economy, Iraq, Afghanistan, and all those different things. You have to excuse me, my allergies are rough right now.
Well, one of the things that I notice is that the mix of interactions that President Obama has with the press are somewhat different than, say, was true for Clinton or even George W. Bush. That Bush and Clinton both had very regular short question and answer sessions with the press, like in the Oval Office. And those started the day after the inauguration. And by this time, say in Bush's case, I think he had at least 50, and Clinton had more than that. He would have had 60 or 70 of these short question and answer sessions. And they did not have nighttime news conferences. Both of them had four, a total of four each in 8 years. And they didn't have their first one until very far in. Only Nixon, who was the first president to have a nighttime newser, had one within his first couple of months. But what you all have had that Bush and Clinton did not have was interviews. The two of them had very few interviews by this time. By my count, you have had at least 24 interviews, whereas in their case, they would have had about 4 or 5 at this point. And they certainly, as I say, had not had nighttime newsers. How did you make those choices of doing the nighttime press conference and then also to select particular news organizations or hosts or reporters or groups of reporters like the regional, you've done 3 regional press. Mm-hmm. How did you make those choices?
Well, what's the, and I'm learning here some too, what sort of format would Clinton and Bush bring reporters into the Oval Office in? Bilats or?
This is when, a head of state comes in, or a head of government, like Gordon Brown. He's going to meet with Gordon Brown either before or afterwards. They're sitting in chairs in the Oval Office on either side of the fireplace, and they take a couple of questions from wire reporters and maybe a couple of others. Not the formal joint newser, but just those short ones. And they would do those so that there, in a sense, was not a buildup that required a news conference. Now, the prime time ones, it's possible that they wouldn't have gotten the time because the networks don't like giving that kind of time away because they have to give up their advertising. But in his case, in President Obama's case, there is such an interest in his presidency that it became an event. They become events that people. You had a huge audience. Mm-hmm. I think it was 40 million for your second.
For the second one. The first one I think was 56, and it was lower than Bill Clinton's first one, which was 63 million. But I think that's because of all the folks who watched it online, as opposed to on TV, where it would have been captured by the ratings. we've only done a half dozen or so of those, short Q&As in the Oval Office. And there's also a lot of things that we do that folks don't necessarily know about. For example, the president has off-the-record lunches with some of the correspondents. We've been trying to do that once a week in his private dining room.
What kind of correspondents would you bring in?
Folks who are in the briefing room. Uh-huh. People who are covering the White House day in, day out.
Uh-huh.
I also organize background briefings with David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and some other folks, and I bring in columnists and opinion writers to come and sit with them for background briefings. Around the the address to joint session of Congress, I organize about a half dozen of those around that with the Vice President and Rahm and Axe. Gibbs did a bunch.
Mm-hmm. What was the thinking behind them?
Well, it's just sessions? We come at this that you just have to take on all of the different mediums that you possibly can at one time. And in order to touch all these different groups and all these different kinds of media, you just have to be aggressive in using all the assets in your arsenal. And so you can knock off a dozen to 15 columnists and have a big impact on the direction of news coverage or the direction of opinion on any particular issue. And on the speech, it was a very important speech, first addressed to Congress, and we wanted to make sure that people had a clear sense of what the thinking behind some of the different elements of the speech were and what it was about this particular economic moment that we were trying to get across and how the president came to the prescriptions for the economy that he came to. So, telling folks in a speech wasn't enough. We had to make sure that people really understood the thinking behind it. And so the decision-making is one that we strategically try to reach out to all the different aspects, all the different elements of the media, and make sure that people have a clear sense of where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm. How do you judge success when you bring columnists in? What are you looking for, and what do you look for after the speech?
Well, President Obama is a great explainer. I think, when he really gets to answering questions. And so what we try to do is emulate that style of making sure that people have a clear sense. And so what we're looking for is a fair shake from some of these folks. The president visited with conservative columnists early on, and that wasn't to try to change their minds on, you know, core values that they hold that they disagree with us on, but at least to be able to see from the administration standpoint how we see a certain issue and how we're taking it on. And I think that so far we've been successful in showing the American people that, yes, we've got these big challenges. A lot of them were here before we got here. But we've got a plan to take them on. And, you know, a lot of these things haven't been tried before. The recovery plan is much bigger than anything that's been passed in our history. But we're also in a place in history that we haven't really seen before, fighting two wars in an economic crisis. And, you know, it's going to take some creative problem solving to get out of it. And so, so what we consider success is at least being able to make our case and not leaving anyone out there who has an unanswered question in a story or a column.
Uh-huh. So do you go back, do you have people assigned to go back and look at what comes out, what the various writers have written?
Yep. I'm personally obsessed with that. I make sure that anybody who we talk to or who comes in for one of these background briefings, that we follow very closely what they wrote. David Brooks, in a recent column, eviscerated part of our economic plan. And I had a couple of folks call him. I had Rahm and Axe call him. A couple other people from the administration called them to follow up with him, too. And he wrote in the next column that he had heard from all these people in the administration. And he rewrote his entire column based on what it was that people had said. It didn't change his mind, but at least it presented what the administration's view was. So I think that what we bring to the administration is, if there's anything from the campaign, from a media standpoint, it's the view that you have to rapidly respond to whatever somebody writes to make sure that, you know, even if they don't agree, they at least present your argument accurately.
Uh-huh. Who are the people that are involved in making the selections, the choices of what you're going to communicate, when you're going to do it, how you're going to do it?
Robert Gibbs plays probably the largest role in all the decision-making that has to do around how we communicate with the media. But the communications director and deputy communications director, Ellen Moran and Dan Pfeiffer, are involved in a lot of the strategic planning and deciding when we might do a certain event and what we need to do around it. Rahm is a very communications-minded.
Right.
And so he gets involved in some of that decision-making, and he likes to be hands-on, so I often have a list of folks that he can call at any given time so that he's got something to do to help make the case. And David Axelrod is also very involved in
what does
process.
He do?
He's the biggest communications and just overall strategist inside the White House. He's got the office that's closest to the president. It's just a couple steps down the hallway. And the president pops in there very often. The other day, this is one of the perils of working in the White House, is that you never know when you're just going to run into the president. I'm standing in Axelrod's office making some, sophomoric, asinine joke, and around the corner comes the president with Arianna Huffington. It's like Burton, Arianna's looking for a round table, and here I'm, like, making some, you know, weird sound with my mouth. I'm like, got it, Mr. President. I'll get it right down to the wardroom. So Axelrod is involved in all the communications, but he's also involved on the policy side in the shaping. He's often been known to say in strategy meetings, if I could just speak for the American people here. He is the voice of the people.
In looking at the choices the president makes about communications and his interest in communications, can you see it having changed from the time when you first knew him and of how he thought of communications and where it fit in to what he was doing to governing?
I would have to think about that question for a while because, you know, right from the start, he had a clear sense of the role that communications would play. And I think that our campaign writ large with Hillary Clinton and John McCain and everything else, you know, was one of the most covered events in, you know, media history. And so we've sort of been at the center of a lot of enormous media firestorms, for better or for worse. On the worse side, there was the Jeremiah Wright's mm-hmm. business. On the other side, there was our trip to Europe, which was, you know, very widely covered. And then, you know, all the way through the debates and mm-hmm. cable TV has made a franchise out of covering this campaign and now this administration that didn't previously exist in the same form. Mm-hmm. So I think that he's very clear-eyed about the role of media, and it's very important to him to clearly make his case when he can.
What do you see as the role of cable? How do you use it?
It's harder and harder to use because it's, you know, there's the saying that every general fights the last war, and it feels like cable is still in campaign mode. You know, there was, I don't remember who wrote the media column yesterday, but they mentioned how, you know, cable channels had countdown clocks on the screen 6 hours before our last news conference, which was, you know, which is great. You know, people should get involved. They should watch the news conference. They should be a part of what's going on. But they treat it like there's this this combative day-to-day, in-and-out, moment-by-moment drama that's being played out in Washington, D.C. It's not really like that. I mean, we're taking on some big things, and they're hard, and there are historic decisions that are being made every single day, but the way cable treats it like it's a, like there's going to be a primetime event every single night is, I think, overhypes it. So how do you use cable? I mean, we spend a lot of time making sure that cable producers and reporters and shows are fed every day. We get them our information. We book guests to make sure that the administration's views mm-hmm. are appropriately represented. And then we try not to watch it too much because it can be polluting.
What do you give them, say, on a regular basis? What would you send? So, for example, say the Bush administration had a rapid response operation where they were sending out a lot of material every day. They would have one that was called In Case You Missed It, that would be, say, an op-ed that somebody in the administration wrote mm-hmm. that might be in the Wall Street Journal. They had president's remarks. They would take a president's speech, strip it down into, you know, maybe 15 points, and they sent those out. They sent those out to cable, fact sheets, sent those. So that's the same kind of thing that you all are doing?
I don't know if it's exactly like that. And, you know, we're still a new administration, and I wonder if we will eventually come to do some more of that. Uh-huh. But right now, like, for example, on our Afghanistan speech, what we did last week was the night before the speech, we brought in producers and reporters from all the major cables, all the networks and the cable networks, and we had a separate briefing for print reporters. And we talked to them on background with senior administration officials to explain to them what the policy was going to be.
How many people were in the room in terms of the media people?
About a dozen in the TV. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about 18 to 20 in the print. Mm-hmm. And we do it in Gibbs's office. We do it before we have any big rollout. Because inevitably there's going to be leaks and people are going to be guessing about what's going to be in the policy that you're going to be announcing one day. And so getting out in front of making sure that people have accurate stories out there about what we're doing is important for cable, first and foremost. But second, just talking to the networks directly about what's going to be in there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we produce documents, like for the auto announcement, there were four separate background documents that we gave to folks to help mm-hmm. guide them in their reporting. Along with the background briefings that we did on that, which we did in the form of a call, not in an in-person briefing. And then during the day, you know, we've got someone who's assigned to booking guests onto their shows to make sure that we get our folks out there. We've got people who monitor what's going on to make sure if anything happens that we need to respond to or we need to correct, that we correct. And then we've got thousands of friends around town who are happy to email us anytime they see something happen on TV that they don't think jibes with what we're trying to do.
Are those people that you have in the press office, or are they elsewhere in the White House, the people that are following what's being said on television?
That's actually a separate part of the operation. It's the communication shop.
Uh-huh.
And the communications office has the TV portfolio.
Uh-huh. What do you see as the difference? And when you look at the whole of your presidential publicity operation, how do you divide it up? Say in terms of what does communications do, how do you see communications, and how is that different than what the press office does?
Well, broadly, the press office is responsible for reacting to and promoting whatever the president is doing today and tomorrow, basically. The communications office is in charge of next week and next month. But there's inevitably overlap because the communications office has often designed events or strategies around whatever you're doing on a particular day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you work together to, you know, like we work with the TV folks to make sure that they've got the most up-to-date talking points or whatever Gibbs most recently said in a briefing about any particular issue.
Uh-huh.
And then also, like our blog operation and the web operation is run out of the communication shop as well. But they obviously have a very integral role in what's going on in media on a day-to-day basis, and so we work pretty closely with them too. So I would say that the separate functions are more a matter of, you know, short-term versus long-term vision, but the implementation is all pretty mixed.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of meetings to make sure we're all on the same page.
Do you see a difference in terms of the press office being responsible for providing information, that that it's more of an objective, down-the-line kind of operation rather than persuasion, that communications is more of a persuasion operation where you're setting things up to get the president's case across, whereas with, say, in the press office, you're responding to reporters' queries. And is there less of an effort to make it a selling operation?
Hmm. No, I would say we're both part of the persuasion bunch because, you know, in the way that we present and deliver information to reporters on a day-to-day basis, I think we're trying to make a case for what the administration is doing. So there are some cold, hard facts that we need to get out there, and we, you know, we try to do every day, be it through the briefing or through other functions of the press office. But we're also trying to do a good job making sure and promoting the president's vision and policies to the American people.
If you're using, say, if you're using the briefing as a persuasion tool, does that make reporters leery of taking your information because they think that that they're the recipients of a campaign to persuade them rather than providing them with information, so that they would question whether they were getting the full story on something, but rather the story that sounds good and looks good?
Sure. I think that reporters are generally pretty skeptical of anything that we say at first blush, and could have stood to have been even more skeptical in the last administration on some of the things that were said and promoted during that presidency. But now, and in the briefing room, my respect for reporters has grown quite a bit since we started here, because I think that they do a good job of pushing us on specifics of our policies to see if, you know, you ask one way or another way, to slice it finely, to make sure that they have a clear sense and can report plainly to the American people what it is that the administration's trying to do. So we present a policy, and we do it in a specific way to make sure that folks can clearly understand it. And reporters try to, you know, find the fault lines, find the weak link in our argument. And, you know, I think that for the most part, it works pretty well at making sure that between the push of our promotion and the pull of the media skepticism, rightful skepticism, that people get the right story.
Do you all have a post-briefing discussion about what you've learned from the press? So it used to be that there was a gaggle in the morning, and the gaggle mm-hmm. set up things for the day, and you could figure out what the issues were with the press and set up a briefing accordingly. And there was a lot people learned within a White House mm-hmm. For the day from the gaggle. And for you all, what do you learn from the briefing? Or is it just a big root canal?
Well, part of my job in the morning is to, I guess, starting back further, Dana Perino told us that the reason she ended the gaggle in the Bush administration was because it oftentimes just turned into another briefing. It was basically the exact same event, the exact same questions, except you just did it on camera for the second round, and reporters would preen a little bit for the cameras in the second time around.
It really was different.
Was it different?
It was different. It had a different cast of characters. It had a more serious group of people. So you didn't have any of the crazies that came in the morning. And
right. I think that our administration would still attract a lot of a lot of different folks who maybe didn't come to the last one.
And what ended up happening for them was because they didn't have the gaggle as a venue where they could respond to issues, say, related to the financial collapse, there before the stock market opened, which the gaggle had been, mm-hmm. that what ended up happening was that they had to use the president all the time, so that the president had to come out every day into the Rose Garden, and so the president became, you know, pretty much overused in that time period because they had given up one of the tools in their publicity kit.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Another difference between our administration and the Bush administration is that our press office is slightly bigger. We've got more spokespeople for the president. And so
how many do you have?
We've got there's Gibbs, and then he's got three deputies, me and two other folks, and then four assistant press secretaries mm-hmm. who are all spokespeople. And then there's a group of regional spokespeople who are in the communications office. And so in the mornings, we're in constant contact with reporters. And we try to find out, you know, what is they're interested in, what are some of the key criticisms uh-huh. of what it is we're doing. And I walk around in the back of the briefing room and I try to pick up, you know, some of those same questions, especially from the TV guys, because they help to, their line of questioning in the briefing often drives the rest of it. But you do, so doing a round of the upstairs and the downstairs, you pick up sort of, you know, what's happening out there. And we talk about that before Gibbs' briefing, and we get a good sense of what the right answers are from a policy standpoint to the questions. And then at the briefing, you know, you get a sense of, you know, what's the tone going to be. And you get one more shot after the briefing to try to get to the reporters and make sure that if you think that they're misrepresenting something, that you make your case in maybe a different way that they might understand.
Uh-huh. When would you do that?
In person. Uh-huh. Like yesterday. What is today? I don't even know what
today's Tuesday.
Yesterday, the autos announcement.
Right.
There were some reporters who didn't understand the difference between what we were doing for the autos, what we were doing for the banks, why it seemed like we had more right. strings attached on the autos right. versus the banks.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I grabbed one of our folks in the National Economic Council, and I brought him around to talk to some of the more skeptical reporters to make sure that our views were accurately reflected.
And were they?
Yep.
On the evening news?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Can you tell us about your day?
Sure. I start my first meetings at 7:15 with Gibbs.
What do you do before? What newspapers do you read? Do you listen to NPR? Do you look at television? You know, kind of when do you get up? When does your day really start?
I'm up between about 4:45 and 5. And I bring the Times and the Post to the gym, and I try to get through those. And then I go home, go to the office, and at the office I print out, we get this news summary. We have this service at the White House that summarizes a bunch of the different outlets.
Is that the same one that the mm-hmm. Bush people used?
Yep. And I try to get through that, and before the senior staff meeting, Reed Turlin, who's an assistant press secretary, and I sit down with Gibbs, and we talk about a couple of things that he might want to get out of some of the senior folks on the the White House staff. Because then he goes to a meeting of about a half dozen folks in the White House with Rahm and a couple other people, and he can get guidance on some of those key questions that we know are going to come up later. And then
is that like a like a management meeting that comes before the senior staff meeting?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then there's senior staff at 8:15, and then we have a press meeting at 8:45, and then a press communications meeting at 9 o'clock.
And who's in the room for both of those?
Well, the press meeting is all 14 people on Gibbs' staff.
Uh-huh.
The communications meeting includes, that's got the communications director and the deputy, me and another deputy, and then a couple people from around the administration who can fill us in on different things that are happening. Like there's somebody from the Council of Economic Advisors, mm-hmm. Cabinet Affairs, Congressional Affairs.
Veep's office?
The Vice President's office is in there. There's about 8 to 10 people,
mm-hmm.
Heavy on the communication side, and we all make sure that everything is all synced up for today.
First Lady?
Tomorrow. Yep, First Lady's representing.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, it's a matter of taking a couple hours to get ready for the briefing.
Mm-hmm.
The briefing is at one or two or
slides
a little bit.
Yeah. What kind of preparation do you all do for Gibbs for the briefing?
I come with a list of top questions that he should be ready for. I try to condense it into, on Afghanistan, sort of the key couple of things that he's getting. And then in that briefing, there's a national security person, Dennis McDonough, who explains what are the two different poles that you need to stay between so that you're not making new foreign policy. And then there's also a guy from the Economic Council who's in there who does the same thing on economic issues. And so then we go through a couple of the things, and, you know, every once in a while I'll have something on the list where Gibbs will go and talk to the president about it directly, or he'll go and talk to a senior member of the administration to get an answer on how we deal with it.
Do you have a conference call with state and CIA, defense, treasury?
We
any
do.
Of those?
We do.
How often?
Every day.
Uh-huh. How long does it last?
I mean, I don't know. Me and Gibbs aren't on those. It's Tommy Veeder, who's the assistant press secretary who handles those issues, is on it with Dennis McDonough.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then if anything pops up on those calls that's of interest, they bring it to the pre-brief.
Do you prepare a briefing book?
Uh-huh.
Yep. Is that one for Gibbs?
Yep. Gibbs gets one that Reed puts together based on the questions that we're picking up around or things that are happening even though there might not be a question.
Do you have a briefing book for the president that that you keep on a regular basis that would keep him up on issues?
Oh yeah, he goes through hundreds of pages of memos every day on the most up-to-date information on issues. You know, by the time a reporter asks us a question about something, it's something that the president has probably thought about for a couple days in meetings with advisors, and the press team is just playing catch up to get up to speed on what other folks already know.
How did you all prepare the president for his two primetime press conferences? Were the preparations similar, and who was involved, and what kinds of things did you do?
Robert Gibbs and Dennis McDonough go into the Oval Office and just go through a Q&A of different things that we think might come up. But it's the sort of process where, I've worked for a lot of politicians, and sometimes they need to memorize a talking point on this or that. But it's very different with President Obama because he has a clear understanding of these issues that he's taking on. He can handle a wide breadth of issues. And so it's basically just going through what you think is on reporters' minds.
Uh-huh. In the first one, did you find that you got most of the questions?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
All of them. I mean, it's there's only a certain menu of things that reporters ask on a
daily basis. Well, let's say one that I thought was
A-Rod?
Surprising. Not the A-Rod, because you know he's come up before. No, it was the one that that dealt with the coffins coming in at Dover Air Force Base. That I thought that was one that would have been very hard to anticipate,
right.
and was very interesting. Ed Henry of CNN asked the question of whether cameras would be allowed at Dover, which they had not been since the Gulf War,
mm-hmm.
and would President Obama change the policy that Biden had talked about it during the campaign. And one of the things you would notice that was that it couldn't have been 2 weeks later than, in fact, they did change the policy, and cameras were allowed and have become allowed at Dover. And I thought it was a good example of the differences that questions can make at a press conference, that there are issues that are raised and points brought up that are followed up.
That's true. That question I don't think we thought would come.
Yeah.
But there was a review in place on that policy because people had, not members of the media, but families had asked about
uh-huh.
it. And so there was a review in place. But yeah, it's definitely a place where the media can push. And Ed Henry and CBS had also been really interested in that issue, and it definitely
uh-huh.
was the media pushing policy.
Uh-huh. After the briefing, but what do you do during the briefing? You sit on the side during the briefing, and what are you doing? Are you writing down particular points that you want to then bring up later?
Uh-huh. I write down all the questions that folks ask.
Uh-huh.
That's more of a tool so that I remember what happened. And I also make notes of the things that Gibbs promises that we'll follow up on.
Uh-huh. And are things actually followed up on?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yep. There's some things that we're just not going to comment or stick our nose into. And sometimes the folks in the media aren't happy that they don't get a particular answer to something like that.
Yesterday, why was Wagner asked to step down as head of GM, and so Gibbs said that Roger from Bloomberg asked that,
uh-huh.
and he wanted to know what the decision making was and the thinking, what were the points, and how did it happen, the TikTok of
right.
And Gibbs said, I'm not going to do it, period.
Right. So in something like that, we didn't follow up with Roger to let him know what the TikTok was in the decision-making process. But if it's something like, what's a good example? Chuck Todd asked, how does the auto warranty program work? Where's the money come from? How much is it going to cost? Gibbs said, I don't know. I'll get back to you. And so we got back to him on the fact that the money will come out of TARP, but it's something down the road, so we don't have a price tag on what it will be just yet.
Uh-huh. What do you do then after the briefing?
We follow up on the questions. There's always a bunch of meetings about something or another.
Uh-huh.
Make sure that the evening coverage is in, the best shape we can possibly make it with our case. And, then we go till about 8 or 10, depending on what's going on, and
mm-hmm.
go to sleep and do it all over again.
Do you watch the evening news as a group? Like
no, it's actually
office?
Something I miss about the campaign, because we were all in, there were 50 of us, all in one big room, and we had 6 TV sets up on the wall, and we would all watch the news and cheer or boo or whatever. And we don't do that anymore. We all have our little offices and just sort of watch it. Sometimes the speechwriters come up and watch it in my little office, but
uh-huh.
that's about it.
Okay. Well, let's go and get some questions. We have 3 different sources of questions tonight. We have the students at Towson. We have the students here at the Washington Center. And then there are students at the University of California at Davis that are going to be sending in some questions. So we're going to try all 3. Towson, got a question? Yep.
How do you view the press's role in our system of government? Yeah.
it's central. I think that without the media and I don't know where I'm talking to, I guess with the camera. Without the media, there wouldn't be, there'd be no central repository for what's ostensibly supposed to be objective reporting. You know, a lot of people come to it with different viewpoints, obviously, and certain media is more, has more of a predilection towards one side or the other, but I think that the media is important in making sure that the government, us, are as honest as possible about the policies that we're promoting and telling the American people about. I'm trying to think of a good example of questions that were asked around. I mean, we're doing all of these very large things. You know, the government has taken ownership of the auto problem. We're taking on the stability of our entire financial system. We've got to turn the economy around. We've got the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq, which we're winding down, Afghanistan, which we're ramping up to take on Al-Qaeda. The media asks tough questions. You know, they've got experts in different fields where they push and prod on, you know, how is money being spent? How effectively are we thinking about what's around the corner? John McCain asked a great question about the helicopters. You know, are we going to get new Marine Ones? I mean, that's the sort of thing that the role that media has in making sure that, you know, we're honest with our dealings with Congress and the American people.
What do you learn from the media? I mean, you send a message out to the public and inform the public. What do you learn through the media?
I mean, on a day-to-day sort of tactical basis, it's where I learn what, you know, Republicans are saying about what we're doing, or not just Republicans, people who have any criticism or specific opposition to something that we're doing. You know, it's they help to give a historical perspective on some of the things that we're doing that we might not have thought of to begin with. And then different folks bring different regional or issue-specific concerns to the table. You know, like, for example, yesterday in the briefing room, there was a reporter from the Detroit Free Press sitting in the USA Today seat who asked questions about the auto industry that somebody from Michigan probably only would ask, but are important to the broader discussion of what we're doing about auto companies.
Uh-huh. Because in ways, there are a lot of things that you can learn from the media. I mean, there are issues that come up that the press brings up that you might not know, the operations of a federal program, for example. There was a lot of information that came out, say, about the rendition program during the Bush administration that certainly was not coming out any other way. So the press informs not just the public, but it informs the government itself.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I actually learned about some of the appointments that we make to different positions from reading Al Kamen's column in the Washington Post on a daily basis.
Well, yesterday he certainly had a big spread of about the numbers and the comparisons with earlier administrations. Yeah, here the question. Okay, in back.
Or fairly recently, that's much better, where he kind of skipped over the questions from the New York Times and a couple other major newspapers. I was hoping you could comment on that in light of you've been speaking about the president's media strategy, and I was hoping you could comment on that.
Sure. It's very hard to bring about change in something like a press conference because, you know, we go into it and you want to really mix things up and not just have the same group of people ask the same questions, not the same questions, but ask questions every time. Because obviously if you look in a room where the president's giving a press conference, there's always more than 100 members of the media represented. However, going back to how hard it is to get time from the networks, you can't not call the networks. They're giving up literally millions of dollars so that the president can talk to the American people about his programs and his policies. Fox, for example, I think, had to give up American Idol that night, you know, which is sort of funny. But at the same time, they lost $5 million on that as a result of broadcasting. So there's a real monetary figure that you can assign to it. And then after that, you know, you've got the wire reporters who speak to the broadest group of folks, and then you only get a couple more slots of people to call on. And you wish you had all the time in the world, but what we wanted to do was make sure that we did something that addressed defense spending, veteran spending, and so we called them Stars and Stripes. We wanted to, let's think, who else did we call on this press conference?
AFP.
Right, we're right on the verge of, you know, this trip to Europe for the G20 and the NATO summit, and we wanted to make sure we addressed an international audience.
Ebony.
And then we try to, like, broaden things out and talk to voters who don't necessarily get their news from watching the evening news or from watching cable all day. And so a reporter like Kevin Chappelle from Ebony, who we called on, we were able to address the question that he had. So our goal is to broaden this out, to change the establishment, to change the way people view the media establishment in Washington a little bit so that we can reach more people and talk to different kinds of folks. Because people just get their news in different ways. You know, I'm sure you've all seen the surveys where folks who are 18 to 25 are more likely to get their news from Jon Stewart or Jay Leno than they are from Brian Williams or Charlie Gibson. You know, that's real. And so the president went out and he was on Jay Leno's show so that he could talk a little bit about the economic moment that we're in. And there were funny parts of it, but it was also, a serious discussion of what was going on in the economy. It's the same reason we did 60 Minutes. And so we just try to broaden it out and talk to as many voters as we can at any given time.
One of the choices you made was to not call on Reuters. The president called on Associated Press, but he did not call on Reuters. And since UPI downsized, Reuters has been called on in every press conference. And one of the reasons I think that presidents call on Reuters is because you address foreign policy. And after the press conference, Rahm Emanuel was critical of the press for not raising foreign policy issues. But Reuters was the opportunity to do that. Why did, whose choice was it not to call on Reuters? Was that something did he just happen to skip over it? Or?
No, Gibbs makes the final call on all those sorts of things. But the decision was just, we were just trying to reach as many people as we possibly could. All around the room. And Reuters had just gotten a question earlier that day in the avail that we did with, I think it was a Japta Hoopschafer from NATO. And so, you know, you just try to spread it out and get around as many folks as you possibly can.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did we have a question? No. Okay. The Towson?
What's your opinion or even what the administration is going to do to prevent critics from considering Obama's presidency to be considered a permanent campaign?
Well, I think that, you know, the best you can do is just take on the biggest challenges and be open and honest about why you're taking him on in that order, why you're making the decisions that you're making about them. And go from there. You know, the term permanent campaign has existed since the Clinton years, I guess, about even earlier about the administration. But, you know, in some ways, I don't doubt that there is a permanency to the campaign in the sense that you constantly have to communicate with the American people what you're doing and why you're doing it. And I think if you lose the energy that people are familiar with on the campaign trail and the advocacy for why it is that you're doing what it is that you're doing, people get the sense that you know, your administration is adrift, that there's no focus to what it is you're doing, something that Jimmy Carter had a problem with and George H.W. Bush had a problem with. And so what we try to do is, you know, we're guided by what the biggest challenges are and you know, spend a lot of time taking them on. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how we view it.
How do you see the difference between campaigning and governing? As having experienced both of them, what do you see the differences being?
Well, the biggest difference is that we don't, our opposition is much less the Republicans than it is these issues, just the sheer challenge of turning the economy around. And I don't think you're judged less on whether or not you score a point better in a debate or in on the evening news than your Republican opponent than you are, have you done something that the American people respect as a good decision as it relates to a big challenge that they face. And, you know, without an organized Republican opposition right now, that's even more true because we don't have to spend as much time taking on the politics of a specific situation on this or that. It's more, what is it about this particular issue that we're taking on, how we're doing it, and why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Zone?
Yeah.
What was the, what would you say the most difficult issue that the media brought up that you had to deal with? Like either during the campaign or during the administration, and how did you deal with it?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard. There were a couple of tough things that we had to take on over the course of the campaign. One was, I would say the answer is sort of broad, which is the juggernaut of the Clinton campaign. Because when we started, and it's hard to even think back to that now, given the fact that we won. But nobody thought that we could win. Like, there were very few people who gave Barack Obama a real shot at beating Hillary Clinton, her fundraising machine, the organization of state and federally elected individuals who supported her. And so we, every day from when he started the race in January of 2007, through the Iowa caucus in January of 2008, had to chip away at this notion that she was unbeatable. And so, you know, the challenge of that is that, and people were looking, the media was looking at the wrong indicators of what was going on in the race. It was this constant who's up and who's down in these national tracking polls. And we never could compete with Hillary Clinton on a national tracking poll before people started to really tune into the race and across the country, and we were able to broaden out the campaign. So what we were focused on was our strategy in Iowa, what it was that we could do county by county, person by person to make our case. And our polls in Iowa were always on a steady incline. We never really ran into trouble, but we also weren't in a position where we were even tied with her until November, late October or November of 2007. So we had this very long stretch of time where people just were very skeptical in the media establishment. So I would say that the challenge was taking on the notion of inevitability, but staying focused on the larger strategic goal, which was win in Iowa, have a plan for New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, February 5th, and all the states that happened after that, and not get caught up in the day-to-day chatter. And for that reason, I think being in Chicago as opposed to Washington helped, because, you know, my wife lives in was in Washington the whole time during the campaign, and I would come to visit on weekends early on. Later, she would have to come out to Chicago because I couldn't get away. But I tell you, going to like Washington cocktail parties where your campaign is in the gutter in national polls, it's very it's tough to stay focused on what you've decided was important and what the campaign has been focused on. So we just took it on by, you know, having a very specific media-focused strategy in Iowa and less focused on the national cable and things like that, and moving forward from there. I mean, from an issue standpoint, I mean, you can't really beat the Jeremiah Wright issue that came up during the campaign, and the way that the president handled that is sort of the way he handles every big thing, is that he just tries to honestly tell people what he's thinking about it. And that's why he gave that race speech. And I don't think we could have turned the corner without him handling that the way he did. He gave the speech on race, and then he gave the press conference where he talked about all the different questions that people had. So the lesson that we, I think, could learn from that is just, you know, open honesty about the decisions you make and why you make them, is important to folks.
It took some while for him to come to that, though, in, to severing his relationship with Reverend Wright.
It was a process, you know.
And what was the process?
Well, without relitigating the entire the entire thing, the process was he was a member of a church where he obviously came to disagree with a lot of the things that he had found out that his pastor had said. And so, you know, as he said in the speech, he just came to the realization that you know, some of the hurtful things that his pastor had said were couldn't be representative of his views on core values or his faith, and he didn't want to be associated with those anymore. So the process was just one of learning more about the issue and then explaining to people how he made his decision.
Did Wright's press conference at the National Press Club play a big role?
It played a role. I mean, because it was one more moment where people learned more about who Reverend Wright was as a person.
An issue that's that has been difficult for you all, and you can tell us how you all have looked at it both before it came up and then as it's unfolded, and that is the compensation for AIG Financial Products Division people. Because that issue just blew up. Did you have any idea that was going to be as kind of nuclear as it was?
I think that the fact that people were really and still are very angry about that didn't surprise anyone. I think that the different reactions that public officials had to it were needed to be managed, and I think that that's what the president tried to do. He tried to take on how we deal with this issue in the future, and then, you know, have his smart folks figure out if there was a way to deal with the issue that we were dealing with in the now. Liddy, the CEO of AIG, made some progress by getting executives to give back those bonuses of their own free will. And the Senate is still deciding how they're going to take it on. But it was a tough issue, and I think people knew that, the president knew that folks would be very angry about it. He was angry about it. Still is. So, yeah, I think that he considered it a justified anger that he just tried to channel into the right kind of action.
Because it just took on such a life of its own, like with Colbert and the Pitchfork.
Yeah.
And that got picked up. That got picked up almost seriously, you know, by some of the critics.
Yeah.
Towson, got a question?
Yeah. My question for you about the news with the...
We can't hear you.
All right. What is working?
I'm sure it cut you out.
In the news recently, there's been like an issue basically on the rhetoric of what we're deciding what's called terrorists and terrorist attacks these days. And my question is, what kind of message is the administration trying to portray, and why are they becoming so pacifist and, you know, what we call terrorists? And are you, why don't we just call them what they are?
I assume that you're talking about the notion of whether or not we use the term war on terror or not. Because folks who are terrorists, we call terrorists. And the whole point of the president's speech on Afghanistan on Friday was to say that we're going to be going after al-Qaeda where they are to make sure that we disrupt and dismantle their ability to attack the United States ever again. You know, as for, you know, this issue of use the war on terror or not use the war on terror, the president made a campaign of the fact that labels are a lot less important than what actions you have around them. And so, you know, the previous administration used global war on terror as a term quite frequently. It's our view that that term and other terms are a lot less important than the policies that you have around the terms that you're using. And so the president thinks that in terms of strategy, his strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan is one that's going to bring more safety to the American people, more stability to that region, and more long-term security than any lexicon of nouns or verbs that another administration might use.
it's okay. Yeah.
Hi. So, in the beginning of the presidential run, immigration was front and center, mm-hmm. and it was a hot topic. I'm asking, why has it died down? When has Obama's press start to? When will Obama's press start to address it again? And is the press team actively avoiding the issue of immigration because it's such a contentious and hot issue?
No, we're definitely not avoiding it. In fact, just last week, the president met with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. They had a great conversation about what we're going to do moving forward on immigration. It's something that's still very important to the president. You're right, he talked about it a lot in the campaign trail, and he talks about it a lot now at the White House. It's a process that is beginning in earnest this year to get comprehensive immigration reform. And so, I don't think that it's something that he's avoiding. There are a lot of things on his plate right now that he's taking on, and immigration is one of those things that, like I said, he sat down and talked to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus about just last week.
I know there are small steps, such as the IKEA provision and S-CHIP, that are being taken with immigration reform, but it just seems that they're trying, that because it's such a hot issue, that they're trying to keep it away from the media. Is that some type of strategy, maybe?
No,
or no?
I wouldn't say so. I would say that, like I said, I go to all the press and communications meetings, and there has been one meeting where people said, let's keep this immigration stuff a little quiet. It's important to the president. He said it was a priority. It remains one, and something that we're going to take on.
How do you decide what things are going to be on your plate, how big your plate is?
Well,
it looks like it's a platter.
Yeah.
And,
there's
with a lot of other candidates to put on it.
Yeah, no, it's
like
true.
Immigration.
There's some things where it's obvious. The president said on day one he would meet with his joint chiefs and the commanders on the ground in Iraq and come up with a new mission.
Yeah.
Which was to get our troops out. So that was part of, that was an extension of what he said he was going to do as president. There's some things like the automotive industry. They're out of money. Like, they can't operate without more money. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't step in, they collapse completely. The financial industry, it's the same thing. So there's an urgency to some of the things that we take on. But in order to make some long-term strategic moves, we've got to do things around those short-term things. Like, for example, on the financial industry, we had to stand up AIG to make sure that it didn't fail, but we also are putting in place regulatory reform to make sure that the sort of thing doesn't happen again. So, it's a mix of short-term fixes, but those short-term fixes have to address a much longer-term issue.
Mm-hmm. How successful do you feel that you've been in bringing together education and energy and healthcare as part of the overall financial picture and as part of the budget?
Ask me that question in 6 months, because I think that it's part of what is going to require somewhat of a sale to Congress and to the American people, that you can't address our long-term structural deficits without taking on the healthcare issue, because Medicare and veterans health and things like that are such a big part of it. And you can't strengthen the economy unless you take some of the healthcare costs off the plates of employers. So you're tamping down economic growth by not taking that on. And energy, it's the same thing. If we're beholden to rising gas prices and our relationship with Middle Eastern countries that are producing our oil, then we're not going to be able to get out of the grip of other folks as it relates to our economic growth. So all the things are connected. Any economist would say so. I think that we've been able to, just yesterday the president was up on Capitol Hill making the case to Democratic members of Congress about it. So I think that there are folks that get it. We're just trying to grow the number of people who get and understand what the issue is as it relates to economic growth and pass our budget and appropriations and health care reform and keep moving forward.
Do you have a regular group of people that assess, like say the president said that what we're going to do is try things and see if they work, and then if they don't tweak or adjust or figure out how you can do it, that means that you've got to have in place groups of people who were assessing that, in addition, say, to the president himself. What kind of groups do you have that are doing that?
Well, as it relates to the economy, the president put in place this review board that's led by Paul Volcker. Mm-hmm. And he's got a couple of staff members for it, and there's a group of folks in the private industry who help to review and assess how our economic policies are doing. And they present their findings to the president once every quarter, but they meet a lot more often than that. And then besides that, there's people inside the White House, inside the administration, who are constantly taking a look at how things are operating. Peter Orszag at the Office of Management and Budget has a team of people who are constantly assessing efficiency and finding different ways where we can cut or tweak or change to make things work better.
Do you have a structure, an organizational structure, that say that within the White House that involves not just policy people but communications people that are going over things on a regular basis and saying, well, you know, maybe we need to explain this more. That maybe, you know, we're losing some support, like support on the Hill. That people on the Hill are worried that you're doing so much at one time.
Well, I mean,
so
the president meets with his senior advisors very regularly.
How often?
Sometimes it's every day.
Uh-huh.
But there's sometimes events don't allow for it. Like he won't on the trip, for example. I mean, he'll meet with some advisors, but not all. And in that group is, you know, Phil Schlereau, who's in charge of our congressional affairs, Robert Gibbs, obviously, David Axelrod, and other folks who are assessing policies, their perception, and their efficiencies, or inefficiencies, to mm-hmm. see what should be changed or tweaked or moved forward. Right. Now, we've just now started to put in place a lot of our economic programs, so it's been a lot more implementation than tweaking at this point. But, you know, as the stimulus bill is out there, the longer the stimulus bill is out there, we're obviously going to have to watch and change and mm-hmm. rein in any wasteful or inefficient spending. But we're just getting warmed up.
Are we back here or are we back in Towson? Huh? Towson, yeah. So thought. Towson?
Yes, sir. Going off the question that the Obama administration is conducting a permanent campaign, it may be seen as a strong point for the administration compared to the last to be willing to be open with virtual town hall meetings and daily briefings. But could that also be seen as a weakness as well from the last administration, where this administration is willing to talk about domestic problems and foreign negotiations compared to the last administration towards those issues?
Well, you broke up a little bit at the end, but I think I get the general gist of what you're saying. And, you know, I think that, obviously I'm biased. I worked for President Obama and I was on his campaign, but I do think that certain presidents fit their moment. And I think that in this moment, the American people were looking for someone who would actually talk to them frankly about the problems that we face and get into the messy details about how they were going to get fixed. And so, you know, whereas at a different time, somebody might say it's weak to even admit a mistake, like this president did right from the get-go on an issue, whereas in the last administration, it was that was something that didn't happen until, you know, the last weeks of the administration. It's there's a different orientation towards how to deal with the challenges that you're taking on. And so, you know, like Professor Kumar was saying, we've done a lot of interviews, and we've done a lot of sitting down with reporters, and we've done it in formats where we can both answer a lot of questions and answer questions in a great deal of depth and granularity, because to this president, it's important that you present what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Okay.
Tough one.
No. I thought the administration, and particularly your office, did an excellent response following the president's, as he acknowledged, a poor taste joke on the Leno show with respect to the Special Olympics and bowling. Could you take us through sort of what it was like for you in the White House or wherever you were, sort of like when the lights went on, how you responded, and what was that a crisis management kind of situation, and just how did the team come together? It's just a sort of an inside baseball kind of thing here. It's just our group here. So just tell us everything we don't know. Since yeah. I've read the press release, but I'd just be very interested to know what it was like for you in there, and because this was a very difficult issue that you handled very effectively, I thought. So
it is video streamed and archived and available.
Well, there wasn't that much, it wasn't that complicated from a press strategy to take on. It was something that the president recognized that he had said that he wanted to clarify. And so we were, I was out on this trip, we were in California. As we left Leno's studio, it's sort of cool traveling with the president because you're flying around in helicopters all the time. And so we drove to this Little League park where our helicopters were parked on the lawn. And we took our helicopters to Dodger Stadium where they were parked so that we could take them to the airport to get on Air Force One. And so it was on the helicopter where I first talked to the president about it. He explained what he wanted to say about it. On Air Force One, I called Gibbs and Axelrod to go over what we were going to say in the statement, and then once we had worked that out, I just walked to the back of the plane and did a quick briefing with reporters who were on the plane just to explain what the president said, how we wanted to clarify it, and that was it. It was sort of, by the time we landed in Washington, it was a dead issue. For the most part. I mean, people covered it the next day, but...
And when it came up at the briefing, it came up at the very end of the briefing the next day when you all were back in Washington, and Gibbs said that there was no excuse for it. So, I mean, he took a very, very strong stand on it. What about Daschle and Daschle's appointment and then the decision? You had arranged 5 interviews, those 5 television interviews, where you were going to talk about the stimulus program. And so it shows the perils of presidential communications because those 5 interviews happened on a day when his nomination fell apart. Mm-hmm. And so then you had to address that. But what was the decision-making going into that and how you would talk about it?
Well, having those interviews scheduled was was more of a blessing than a curse in our view because, you know, back to this president just wanting to explain what it is that he's doing and why he's mm-hmm. doing it. It gave an opportunity to take on what was turned out to be a very high-profile story that people were talking about and didn't quite understand our thinking on. So, but you're right, I set up the interviews for a completely different purpose, and all the anchors from the evening news broadcast came to the White House, and we had a series of Oval Office interviews. And the reason we did them in the Oval, the reason we did this was because there's a lot of pressure over who's going to get your first Oval Office interview. In order to relieve some of that pressure, we just did a round robin with all the anchors. And so, I mean, ultimately, we were going to be talking about the economy, selling the recovery plan, but Daschle happened. The president knew exactly what he wanted to say about it. It wasn't a matter of scripting any of that. And he just went into the interviews and said exactly how he felt, which is that he had made a mistake and was moving on, having learned from it, to keep building his administration and moving forward.
One of the things he really didn't say was what was the mistake.
Well, I think that what the president would say is that the mistake was thinking that this sort of attitude towards this permissiveness towards tax evasion or towards any of these excesses that had come into light would still be okay. Mm-hmm. And so he just didn't want to make it seem like there was that this administration was just like a Washington establishment that he had run against. He wanted to be the change that he had talked about on the campaign trail. And he didn't think that this was a very change moment.
because in reality, you all didn't know about the underpayment of taxes until pretty late in the game. So I didn't know if it referred to the process itself.
No, not as much, because the process itself had operated as well as it could under the circumstances.
Uh-huh.
We would have never known about the problems unless Dashiell himself had come forward and said it. So nobody would have known about it, from the IRS to anybody else, but it was something that he made an issue in. So,
although the Senate has, they have somebody on detail,
right,
from the IRS.
Right, but this was something that even they had missed. So there was, there were a couple different problems with that.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. We need, okay. Oh, yeah, we had it. We need a young woman right over here with a white coat.
I just worked here, so.
Yeah.
It's on? Yeah. Earlier you mentioned Twitter.
Yes.
This is kind of shifting the topic a little bit. And I know social networking played a huge role in Obama's campaign. How is it addressed now that he's in office? What is its role? Does it come up in meetings? And, yeah.
It does. And it's actually a lot more challenging than you think for us to stay as connected to folks as we were on the campaign trail. In large part because of, we inherited a lot of bad stuff from the last administration, from, you know, policies on foreign and economic policy, but the thing that affects me most day to day is the equipment we inherited. The computers are terrible. The email goes down all the time, and the hardware can't actually support a lot of the things that we've tried to do with our website. And we also, because of security protocols that were put into place before the advent of Facebook and personal email accounts, which seems like it would have been forever ago but still haven't been updated at the White House, we're not able to effectively use all the tools that were at our disposal before. So we're in the process of, as quickly as we can, changing to, first of all, bigger and faster servers that can host a website that has more video and social networking capability, to reviewing our security policies to make sure that, you know, we're not just blocking out Facebook and Gmail and Twitter because, you know, former administrations that, for which it wasn't as important a tool, didn't use it as much and didn't do what they needed to do to adjust to, you know, a new internet age where people use these tools a lot more. So it's important to us, but it's not reflected as much as might be suggested by its importance yet.
Well, in every administration, when they come in, they're surprised that that their campaign had much higher level of technology than exists in a White House. And if you think about it, why should the Congress be supporting some huge, you know, communications operation and high technology in a White House?
Just running the country.
Well, they also see it as something can be used against them too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So that it's always seemed to be a surprise, but the Bush people did a lot in some of the infrastructure, like the Situation Room. They just took that all apart and built an entirely new Situation Room.
Oh, is that? Well.
And an entirely new communication system. When Bush came in, he took a trip in March of 2001, and he went to Camp David for the weekend. And it was snowing, and so he couldn't take the helicopter, and he had to take the limousine. And it takes 90 minutes. And for that 90-minute trip, there was no communications whatsoever. There was not even a cell phone that worked in the presidential limousine. So the president was totally out of touch. And when they came back from Camp David, it was the same thing. And so the next day, he wanted a review of what was at fault. And so they found a lot of problems, a patchwork communication system. And that led to a redoing of the Situation Room. So
that's amazing.
Actually, yes, it is. To think of a president being twice for 90 minutes being totally out of communication with nothing working. So it's not as bad as it was. Well, on that, it's 7:30, and we've compelled you for an hour and a half there, and we've all learned a great deal. And thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Learned a lot.
Thanks, guys.